and welcome to Worlds Apart. Historically, the European continent is well ahead of all others in terms of the number, the scale, and the deadliness of the wars fought on its territory. And until recently, Europe has also been one of the major recipients of the so-called peace dividend, the prosperity and growth that came from managing geopolitical tensions diplomatically. Which way is it likely to lean now after the West's latest war for peace project in Ukraine seems to have run aground? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Ola Tunander, an emeritus professor at the Peace Research Institute Oslo. Professor Tunander, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
Thank you.
Now, I just mentioned the peace dividend that the European policymakers used to mention quite a lot just a couple of years ago as one of the major achievements of the post-World War II era. And that peace dividend, to a large extent, came from a very profitable economic cooperation, first with the Soviet Union and then later on with Russia. And yet it was also very easily given up upon once the conflict in Ukraine began to escalate. Do you think without this material or even mercantilist benefit, do you think peace in Europe is possible?
I think it's possible, but I think it's very problematic at the moment, because I think among the new generation of political leaders and journalists, they are actually, they don't have a professional experience from the Cold War. So they think in terms of being able to tell the opponent how to behave. It is a, you could say it's a kind of hubris. It is the experience is from the wars on the Balkans, in the Iraq war, in the Libya war, which all were catastrophic, of course, in many ways, but the Western countries were superior from a military point of view. And in relation to Russia, that is not the case. I think it's really problematic because it's a kind of a generation that could not admit that we are having a conflict with an equal touch.
Professor, I think you don't need to have an immediate experience of something to understand the potential dangers or benefits of it. For example, I mean, we don't need to fight with you personally for me to understand that, you know, I could face certain consequences. And yet it seems that the current generation of policymakers or journalists that you're referring to is also pretty much oblivious to the entire history of the 20th century that our continent has went through. I mean, you have this wonderful, very evocative painting behind your back, you know, showing the horrors and the suffering of the people in the World War II that happened on our continent. And yet, for some reason, it seems to be not penetrating to the kind of elites that you're talking about.
I know quite a few people who has positions at the time and are part of the advisory boards and so on. But they lack the understanding of what you had during the Cold War, that you could actually have an escalation to nuclear. And this is forgotten, I would say. And they know it from reading the books, they don't believe in it anyway.
Okay, if they don't know about it, let's try to educate them a little bit on that. And you have written quite extensively about the underpinnings of Russian security thinking. I think it doesn't really change from leader to leader or from ideology to ideology, because it's not political. It's ultimately rooted in the survival of Russia as a state. And you have written in your articles that historically, major threats to a Russian state came from the West. Those attacks, you know, went deep into the Russian territory, and that's why the Russian leadership, regardless of its ideology, thinks that it is wise to have a certain buffer around Russia. And what we have in Ukraine right now, it's not really about Ukraine; it's about the square footage that Ukraine is sitting upon. Why do you think it was important for the West to try to put that to a test? Because, I mean, this is not something that Putin has invented. This has been there for centuries.
It is a problem I think in Britain and the United States, or parts of the US elite and part of the British elite, actually are very used to deception, that you fool your enemy, but also your friend. And that is one of the more problematic sides, because, of course, we know, or many people would know, and you could just read the cables from Bill Burns, the former director of the CIA, and that at 2008 he was ambassador to Moscow. No, it was very clear that he took the Russian way of thinking seriously, and this was a red line. Ukraine was a red line, for definitely a red line for Russia, and so they knew it. And the problem, I think, was that they had immediately, when the war started, they claimed that Russia wanted to conquer the Ukraine, or conquer the whole of Ukraine. While, for example, the Russian side and the Ukraine side said that they wanted to have a neutral Ukraine. That was what they said. But not one single journalist, not one single political leaders in the West said that. And then you have to wonder, what does it come from? And I think that you start a narrative immediately after an event, and that creates a kind of fake understanding of the situation.
Professor, you have also written that unlike the Russian fixation on this buffer protection zone, Western security strategists think in terms of deterrence, containment, and rollback. And I wonder, what's the point, as far as you are concerned, what's the point beyond which, in their view, Russia needs to be contained? Is there any level of Russia's relative success or well-being as a state that would not be deemed as threatening to these people?
From the strategic community in Britain and in the US, or part of the neoconservatives in the US, they would consider Russia as a threat, whatever they do. I mean, I think that, for example, at the end of the Cold War, President George H.W. Bush and his Secretary of State Baker, they were very seriously talking with Gorbachev and promised a lot of things. And while the National Security Advisor Scowcroft wrote internally that the United States should move forward and place itself between Germany and Russia. And this was actually, or Germany and Soviet Union, this was late 89. So it was a dual strategy from the West side, where you had a nice facade when you spoke with Gorbachev, and then you had a real strategy that the idea was to move forward after.
So it's a policy of deception, and not only deceiving your opponent, but I assume also your domestic population. Now, you mentioned the Cold War, when Russia was recognized as an enemy and as a powerful enemy because it had nuclear weapons, and nuclear deterrent is a very interesting concept in geostrategic studies, because ultimately it's a way to compensate for your lack or shortage in conventional military capabilities, and the country that has nuclear weapons can guarantee its survival. Before the war in Ukraine began in its kinetic form, I think we saw sort of a total lack of recognition, I guess, that Russia has those nuclear weapons. Do you think it was ignorance, or do you think it was a deliberate attempt, perhaps, to nullify the advantages that nuclear weapons give to Russia strategically, because ultimately it's always been pretty clear that it will use them if its vital interests are threatened.
I think I saw an interview with Michael Clark, who was heading the Royal United Services Institute in Britain, and a professor in defense studies, and also had been in politics also. And he said that we don't believe in any nuclear threat, any kind of problem with that. And the Scandinavians and the Baltics had the same view. While the Germans and the South Europeans are more worried about nuclear weapons. So, and I think his argument was that if Russia used nuclear weapons, we could use nuclear weapons against Russia. So it doesn't make sense. The problem is, I would say that that now Russia has conventional missiles that are quite capable. So like the Oreshnik missile that could take out air bases in any European country. And the problem is that the British has nothing to respond with in that sense. So so in that sense, it would be Britain that goes nuclear, and Russia would, in that case, would be much stronger. So, and I don't think the US will try to involve it, actually. I think the US, at least the present administration, but they, for them, if they would attack the Kola Peninsula, for example, the Murmansk naval bases, Russia would attack Norfolk naval air station, naval police stations close to Washington. It's no point for United States to involve itself. And in that sense, you could say that the nuclear umbrella that NATO has been so proud about really doesn't exist.
Now, can I ask you about this? Because it is pretty amazing, I guess, and surprising for us to see that the thinking in Washington has changed, and that the new administration in Washington at least takes not Russia, but nuclear weapons seriously. But I think the old thinking in Europe continues, and Europe seems to believe that, you know, Russia can still be put into a position it wants. How long do you think this division between Europe, Western Europe, and the United States will last? Do you think Europe has what it takes to sustain it?
I think that if you look at the threat assessment recent, or a few days ago, from the Trump administration, from the U.S. intelligence community, they write very clearly that if they will continue the war, and that would mean, for example, security guarantees for Ukraine or something like that, that would mean a war, a shooting war between US and Russia. And that would easily escalate into a nuclear war. So, and that is, I mean, clearly stated that this is, you could not have these security guarantees, because it is a, and I think what happens now in Europe with European countries, that they believe that their deterrence is so amazing, so the Russians wouldn't dare to do anything.
Well, that's an interesting thing. They don't believe that Russia would use nuclear weapons, or that Russian nukes are serious, and yet they somehow rely on the American protection and take it seriously. That's quite a paradoxical way of thinking, but let's discuss it after a short break. We need to take it right now, but we will be back in just a couple of minutes. Stay tuned.
What is Bharat? Is it a travel ad? Is it a Bollywood poster? Is it the deepest yoga center in the world? Or is it something deeper, more complex, multifaceted? Let's talk without cliches. Let's talk Bharat.
خنقت ابن الرضيع لأنه كانوا هنا المخبئين جوات مقبرة كرمال الأتراك ما يكشفوهم. خنقت ابن الرضيع مشان ما يبكي ويطلع صوته وهن يعني كمان يكونوا من الناس اللي ينقتلوا بالإبادة.
Через эти пески турки гнали армянских женщин, детей, стариков. Сотни тысяч погибли в этих песках.
The Assyrians, just like the Armenians, were forced to flee their homeland.
كل سنة بحلب بسوريا بشكل عام كل مدن في أرمن شتات بيصير في مارش عسكر مارش بيصير في مسير من الشموع تخليدا لذكرى الناس اللي فقدناهم بالإبادة الجماعية اللي حصلت ب 24 أبريل 1915.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Ola Tunander, an emeritus professor at the Peace Research Institute Oslo. Professor, just before the break, we were talking about nuclear weapons and nuclear deterrent, and that European nations believe that they have the nuclear capacity or the nuclear umbrella provided by the Americans, even though they don't believe that the Russian nuclear weapons represent a threat to them. That's quite a paradox. But there are many other paradoxes in the European strategic thinking. And one of the reasons why Americans are no longer willing to finance the war in Ukraine is because they see no benefit for themselves. What are the benefits for the Europeans to keep on this war track? What do you think they're trying to achieve for themselves?
They have painted themselves into a corner. They could not back out, and they are unable to understand security politics, I would say. I mean, you had the General Secretary of NATO before from Norway, and his background was he studied economy. Yeah, not security politics. He was not. And the problem then is that you have to listen to your advisors. And if you don't know too much yourself, you have to listen to your advisors. And they might have a very different agenda. They may actually want to have a war. I mean, if you go back to this British professor Michael Clark, he was worried about Biden in the last autumn. He was worried about Biden that he didn't want to use the long-range missiles against Russia because he was afraid that of an escalating war, and he didn't want to have a war in the last minute of his presidency. It looked bad. So the problem was the White House, said this my talk. And this is the kind of thinking that I think is pretty dangerous.
You know, just the other day, talking about this kind of thinking and the kind of understanding of security policy in Europe, the German economy minister said the other day that the EU needs to increase the pressure on Trump and to see who is stronger at arm wrestling. If you had to put your own money on that, which side would you side on, Trump or the new German economy minister?
I'm not going into that, but I don't think that it's very... I think the Germans have behaved extremely irrational, and And not least when it comes to, you know, the role of the Nord Stream pipeline, which is, you know,
the role of the economy, absolutely. You know, the energy resources, the market for your goods, etc., all of that was lost. I mean, the Germans are one of the biggest losers.
Of course, they lost more than Russia, you could say, when it comes to the Nord Stream pipeline. So it is catastrophic for Germany, and they accepted it, and that is a, you could say, that was a sign of a vassal status for Germany in relation to the United States. The problem now is that the United States has changed 90 degrees, and now people in Europe don't know what to do. So it's very, very strange. I mean, in the 1980s, you had kind of independent thinking in Germany. You have the, you know, you have, or in the 70s also, you have the Ostpolitik of Willy Brandt, and you have the Helmut Schmidt, who was, you know, pushing very much for the gas pipeline. And while the Americans wanted to cut it, I mean, they actually succeeded to detonate or destroy the pipeline somewhere in Siberia in 1982. But the Germans and the Soviets continued building the pipelines, and they couldn't stop it. And the Europeans were all on board for the pipeline, even the British. But now they have succeeded to change this. So it is I think it's amazing how weak the Europeans have been.
Well, Professor, in a paradoxical way, the war in Ukraine, the current developments at least, allow the Europeans to demonstrate for the first time in many decades that they have at least a semblance of strategic autonomy from Washington. How do you think they are likely to use it?
I don't know. I don't know. I think they are, you know, they will, could easily get into a lot of trouble. I mean, they will try to have some kind of a security guarantee for Ukraine, and of course, and they believe in a way that Britain and France is strong enough to you know, to really push the Russians back, and that is the. I think that from a Russian point of view, the if there would be British or French troops coming in, they would be a primary target. So it is a, and then of course comes the question, how will the Europeans react? And of course, to a large extent, they will react to say that, you know, the Russians are very evil and so on, and we have to fight them, and we might have a big war in Europe. But as I understand, the Russians are not interested in moving troops westwards at all. If the Russians are threatened by US or British air bases in the vicinity of Russia, then they will take them out. If they war that will include the European countries.
Professor, I know that you have also researched the war in Libya, which I covered as a reporter on the ground, and it was a pretty heartbreaking experience to see how a relatively prosperous country can be thrown into dark ages in just a matter of months. But to some extent, it's also a blueprint of what the Western operation can do to a country, because the West moves in, then it leaves the country, disposes of its leadership, leaves the country in a state of savagery, which I think what happened to Libya, and goes on. Now, do you think such scenario is likely for Ukraine? How do you think the West is likely to deal with the Ukraine going forward?
The British Foreign Office, actually, or the Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee, made a pretty serious investigation And they found, for example, that there were no real threats to the population in Libya from Gaddafi's side. I mean, this was just made up by certain agencies.
Absolutely. There were lots of fake reports. I can tell that as somebody who was on the ground. You know, all these concocted reports of Gaddafi's Viagra and the soldiers doing mass rapes, that has all been proven wrong. And yet it got, at that time, it got a lot of support from the officials in Western capitals.
And it was kind of mass killings to a certain extent, but that was the Islamist rebels who was responsible for that in Taberga, for example, as you well, so it was just fake pretext. I mean that they were brought up, and you could, if you compare to Ukraine, there were some killings in the Donbas 2014 to and 15 and onwards, and killing some 14,000 people and 3,400, I think, civilians. And this was not understood as a reason for a responsibility to protect operation or something like that. So it's clear that international law is used for your own purpose. And the tragic thing, I think, is that the political leaders, I mean, leaders that I know, and, you know, they believe in what they are saying. They actually believe in what has, you know, that the responsibility from the Russian side. And in general, I think that political leaders, they have too much to do. They have no time to go into depth. Mm-hmm. They have an intelligence service that manipulate the information. You are totally dependent on.
Well, I think one similarity between the conflict in Libya and the current conflict in Ukraine is that both of them have produced very large refugee waves into the European countries. And whether or not European leaders take time to study security policy, history, or what have you, you know, the citizens of their countries can feel the brunt of those policies, you know, in their own lives. It means increased social spending. It means increase in crimes. There are many other negative consequences. And I wonder, what is it about the European way of processing reality that allows not only for the leadership, but also for the large populations to stay blind and unresponsive to this kind of reality feedback? Because everything shows that these policies are not working, that they're hurting not only the other countries, but also the European countries themselves.
It's impossible to understand. I think it's really, you know, it was very easy to see that when they started the war in Libya, when they started the war in Syria, at almost the same time, that it will lead to a lot of refugees, but there is no kind of these kind of conclusions.
Well, Professor, reality by its very nature is inconclusive and uncertain, so I guess we will also have to leave this interview without any certain answers to my questions, but I appreciate your being here. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.